undercurrent of the politics of death, that, you know, you're going to hear about it on the news. They're going to show you the crime scene. They're going to show you the body. They're going to show you all the details of the apprehension of this horrible, horrible person. And this is the crime that they're alleged to have committed. But they may say alleged, but by the time the people who are the potential jurors hear it, he's already tried, convicted, and sentenced.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, June 21st, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in, or glanced over by, the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll take an in-depth look at the problems with capital punishment as the federal government carries out executions for the first time since 1963. Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms speaks with death penalty appellate lawyer Andre Hirun. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Thursday, June 21st, 2001. More than 25,000 demonstrators converged on the city of Gothenburg, Sweden, last weekend to oppose economic policy talks between U.S. President George W. Bush and the leaders of the European Union nations. On the afternoon of Friday, June 15th, as many as three unarmed people were shot by police after a Reclaim the City action. Police charged into a crowd of about 1,000 people who had gathered in a park. One young man was shot through his lung with live ammunition after he hurled a stone at an advancing line of police. Street medics attended to him almost instantly at the scene, and later he underwent surgery. His condition has since improved, and it appears he will survive. At least one other person was shot in the leg. More than 600 people were arrested in the demonstrations. For more information on the EU summit protests, please visit the Independent Media Center of Sweden on the web at www.sweden.indymedia.org. On May 19, 2001, hundreds of people protested at Vandenberg Air Force Base to stop the U.S. from exploiting outer space for the sake of the U.S. economy. Vandenberg Air Force Base is the world's largest U.S. Space Command facility and operates a system of surveillance satellites used to track the movements of opposition forces rising up in places like Colombia. 32 people were arrested in actions around the base, and many of the demonstrators were in court on Monday, June 18th. Scott Galindez of Los Angeles Catholic Worker was arrested May 20th in a backwoods occupation on the base. He explains what went down in court.
Seven of the people who did the line crossing received 3 years supervised probation and $85 in fines after pleading guilty. The other... out of the 10 of us, two people remain incarcerated. They both have not accepted bond or conditions of release, and they've remained locked up since the 20th. And seven of us are scheduled for trial July 31st. We expect that some of those will plea bargain before then, but I think at least three of us are going to have a trial.
Ed Rippey, a journalist arrested at the Front Gate action on May 19th, accepted a 3-year probation and $85 fine. For more information on the cases as they progress through the courts, contact the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, California, on the web at www.rcnv.org. Jackie Jackson, the wife of Reverend Jesse Jackson, was arrested along with 39 other protesters on Tuesday, June 19th, the day after the United States Navy resumed bombing exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. The group had entered the firing range, demanding an immediate end to the target practice. Last week, President Bush had announced that the Navy would leave Vieques by 2003, the same time frame slated by former President Bill Clinton. But many island residents, and even the governor of Puerto Rico, have rejected the proposal and are demanding an immediate halt to the bombing exercises. A referendum about the Navy exercises previously brokered by former President Clinton and former Puerto Rican Governor Pedro Rosello is scheduled for November 2001. Puerto Ricans have also scheduled a non-binding vote in July. Meanwhile, on Thursday, June 21st, a United Nations Committee on Decolonization Issues adopted a resolution calling on the United States to expedite independence for Puerto Rico and ordered an immediate end to U.S. military exercises on the tiny island of Vieques. It calls for the United States to, quote, return the occupied land to the people of Puerto Rico, halt the persecution, incarcerations, arrests, and harassment of peaceful demonstrators, immediate release all persons incarcerated in this connection, and decontaminate the impact areas in the Vieques bombing range. 23 people were killed on a soccer field in Talafar, Iraq, on Tuesday, June 19th, after what Iraqis say was a U.S.-British airstrike. The Allied military officials said a mission was flown over Iraq's no-fly zone Tuesday, but denied warplanes fired on any positions. This comes as two former heads of the United Nations Oil for Food deal, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, condemned a proposal to revamp the 11-year-old UN sanctions policy on Baghdad. They said the proposed smart sanctions were designed to extend an embargo imposed on Iraq for its 1990 invasion of Kuwait and called for an end to sanctions against Iraq, calling them genocidal and a crime against humanity. And finally, Jerry Skilling, CEO of the Enron Corporation, a Texas-based energy conglomerate, was hit with a blueberry tofu cream pie on Thursday, June 21st, as he was preparing to give a talk called The Roles and Responsibilities of the Energy Industry at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Agent Chocolate Supreme of the Biotic Baking Brigade shouted, "This is for the millions you've stolen from California's real working people," as he threw the pastry. The Enron Corporation is one of the largest beneficiaries of California's energy crisis. They reported an income of $777 million in the fourth quarter of the year 2000, while citizens were simultaneously facing substantial rate hikes and rolling blackouts. Agent Chocolate Supreme reportedly evaded apprehension, and this dangerous criminal is still on the loose. And those were headlines for the week ending Thursday, June 21st, 2001. From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to the Weekly Freak Show on Micropower 102.9 FM in Dade City, Florida. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. That was Los Federales with this week's spotlight sound, Reptilians, a true story from their new release La Maldacion de los Federales on No Theme Records. Despite lingering questions about the racial and geographic equality of the federal death penalty, President Bush and the U.S. Supreme Court refused to delay the execution of Juan Raul Garza, and he was put to death by lethal injection on Tuesday, June 19th, at the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, the same place Timothy McVeigh was executed 8 days earlier. Garza was convicted in 1993 of murdering a man by shooting him 5 times and ordering the deaths of 2 other men as part of his marijuana smuggling operation. Many wondered whether Garza, a Mexican-American born in the United States, would have been sentenced to death if he were white or had committed his crimes elsewhere. For more than 5 years, Andre Herron was a prosecuting attorney in the state of Missouri. After some time off to further her studies, she decided to rejoin the legal profession, this time as an appellate attorney for people on death row. She says it is a common shift and that she viewed the switch as an opportunity to address more directly the injustices inherent to the death penalty system. Andre has a unique perspective on the death penalty as an attorney and as a member of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, a group of people who have lost family members and loved ones to homicide but still oppose the death penalty. She's lost a number of relatives to murder, including a brother, both before and after she became a death penalty appellate lawyer. Freak Radio's Old Lady Scararms recently spoke with Andre Herron about her stand on capital punishment. She begins with an explanation of her choice to work against the death penalty.
It's kind of interesting how I came to that position, because I think as a DA, I didn't do capital work. I didn't try capital cases. I may have charged a few capital cases, but I didn't actually try any. And I didn't have a real strong position one way or another about the death penalty. I really didn't come into contact with it that much, and certainly not enough to make me have to make a choice about it, although I suspect my instincts would have compelled me to certainly have a lot of questions about it, if nothing else. I pretty much took my cues from Thurgood Marshall, who was categorically against the death penalty, and I felt, he being one of my heroes, that if he was against it, that was a good enough position for me. I think since I have come to do the work, that position is informed by what I have seen in the way of the kinds of cases that get charged capitally, the people who typically get charged with capital offenses, as well as the corruption that exists within the system, and just the basic flaws that come from the fact that it's being run, designed by human beings. So I think all those things would tend to make one think again about whether or not the death penalty is an appropriate sanction for us to engage in as a society.
Mm-hmm. So you say that you came to become opposed, you became opposed to the death penalty because you agree with Thurgood Marshall. Was there some other thing that pushed you to have to decide what your position was on the death penalty?
Well, I think it's really a pretty logical position to come to once you have a global sense of the system. I think if your position is limited to looking at the issue from the perspective of what the defendants have done and the heinousness of the crime and that sort of thing, I think that limited perspective would make you tend to be in favor of the death penalty. I think the more information you have about how it operates, upon whom it operates, and what its purported effect is, then I think you would come to a different position, because when you learn about the kinds of money that's being spent to perpetuate the system and those kinds of factors, the bias that's inherently present in the system, the kinds of factors that drive the death penalty, which very often have nothing to do with what is just, but have to do with a lot of political issues that are tangential to the issue regarding the crime itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all those factors would tend to make one, that is, the more one knows about all the things that really go into the death penalty, the more likely one is to reach the conclusion that there's a better way to address the problem of violent crime in this society.
When the murders happened of your loved ones, was your position on the death penalty, did you question?
Well, you know, before I became involved with the issue of the death penalty, I don't think I really thought about it in those terms. Certainly I wanted justice to take place, but I don't think my natural inclination was ever to think people should be put to death. Now, that may have had something to do with the person's relative position in my life, like if it was a distant cousin or something like that. It's a different sense about it than if it's somebody who's in your life on a daily basis, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound cold or uncaring about relatives who I didn't have as close relationships with. But the point is that
my knee-jerk reaction was not to think I wanted whoever perpetrated these offenses to be put to death. I think when it was a relative who was much closer to me,
your brother,
in this case my brother, I think my gut instincts were to want to go out and do something to the people who had done something to him. And I think that it's fair to say what I felt like doing was killing those people. I think there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that impulse, but I think part of my position against the death penalty is that it appeals to our worst impulses, and it appeals to those impulses that are least calculated to achieve what we want to achieve, which is to get back at that person for what they did to us. And the only way that could happen is if we could get the person we lost back. I think anything short of that is simply revenge, and it's misdirected rage.
So would you say that maybe what you're presenting here is the position that family members of those who've been murdered, it shouldn't be up to their instincts to decide? We shouldn't have revenge be the justice system.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the whole point of not letting our personal sense of retribution govern is that we are a nation of laws and not of men. That's one of the key credos of this society. And one of the reasons why we take that position is because in our infinite fallibility, human beings will choose the outcome that is least, that when it's based on their emotion, is least likely to do good for the society at large. So to have a system based on our personal emotions and views of what justice is would lead us to vigilantism, basically. And I mean, we've seen that played out in less ominous circumstances, such as road rage. When we're left to our natural impulses and the impulses that drive us when we're in a rage, they lead to the worst results. And I think that's the same case whether or not it's individual or it's done by the society at large. Now, that's kind of the philosophical argument, but I think there are a lot of other pragmatic arguments against the death penalty, regardless of what your instincts tell you about what the proper punishment might be in a situation. I mean, it's not cost-effective, it doesn't deter people, and it's only exacted against the most disenfranchised and poorest people in this culture.
Let's deal with the first thing you said, it's not cost-effective, because a lot of people would argue that it's probably cheaper to kill somebody.
Right.
Now, how would you respond to that?
I think that there are a number of studies that refute that notion, but I think what people fail to realize is that because of the way the laws are structured in this culture, when someone is charged with a capital offense, they're entitled to what is regarded as super due process. And so it adds to the cost of the case. Now, that doesn't even take into account the costs that are associated with investigating the case, trying it, perhaps sometimes sequestering the jury, the length of these cases, because of their complexity and the publicity that attends them. All of these things tend to add to the cost. And then that's even before we get into once the person is convicted and the fact that they have the right of automatic appeal and so on. Now, a lot of people have problems with the appellate process, and they say that people are prolonging the inevitable based on technicalities and this sort of thing. But I think what recent news has clearly demonstrated to us is that the error rate in these cases is enormous. And one of the reasons why the error rate is so high is because they are driven by these political considerations that sometimes provoke law enforcement to do things that are unconstitutional, that are illegal, that are unethical, just for the sake of obtaining a conviction, either because people are so freaked out by the horror of the crime that the police feel pressured to just nail somebody, anybody, and because they think somebody's good for it, or because they know that a person has a history of criminal behavior, they, you know, will sometimes place the burden on that person without there being accurate or sufficient evidence to really find that person guilty.
Or they'll create the evidence, falsify
exactly.
It, plant
so
it.
So I think all of those things come into play, and all of those things tend to add to the cost, because when the appeal is being taken and these matters are being investigated and the state is stonewalling because they don't want to admit they made a mistake or they disappear evidence or witnesses are threatened or otherwise put out of commission, and all of these things are things done by the state. This is not the defense driving this process. And all of those things add to the cost. What studies have shown is that to keep a person in jail for life, for their natural life, averages out to about $750,000, whereas prosecuting a capital case and taking it all the way through to execution has been estimated to cost anywhere from $3 to $5 million. Right there, the whole process is not cost effective, and it doesn't do what it purports to do.
You mentioned that it's not a deterrent. How would you back that?
Well, I think because when you really think about the crime of murder, now, and this really gets into some additional arguments that have to do with the fact that in California in particular, virtually every murder can be charged capitally because of special circumstances and that sort of thing. But when you just think about the phenomenon of murder, it is one that typically happens, not always, but just as often as not, it happens between and among people who know each other. Very often murders arise out of crimes of passion. Now, they also arise out of other criminal acts like robbery, burglary, rape, so on and so forth. But they just as often arise out of these kind of domestic situations or barroom brawls or drug dealing situations and that kind of thing. Because they happen in these kinds of circumstances that very often are unpredictable and not the kinds of things that a police presence could necessarily affect. Because when murders happen inside of a person's house, for instance, that's not something that police are necessarily in a position to prevent as they would be, you know, if they were patrolling an area with businesses and they could prevent a robbery. If I don't want to go off on too many tangents here. But the point I'm making is that most times when people are involved in the act of murder, number one, they aren't thinking about the fact that if I do this, I could get sentenced to death, because they're unpredictable situations that happen in the heat of passion and so on and so forth. Secondly, people who are out there involved in purposeful, wanton criminal behavior are not planning on getting caught. So they aren't thinking about the death penalty as a deterrent. I think another point worth making is that because the people who tend to be caught up in the criminal justice system, there's a high correlation with that behavior and the fact of poverty and deprivation. Many of the people caught up in the criminal justice system are people who are living with death every day in their normal, everyday circumstances. And so these are not the kinds of things that are sufficient incentive to make them say, I'm not going to do this because I might get the death penalty. So I think it doesn't serve the purpose that we like to think that it does, in that it doesn't really deter people. It deters that one person, but so does life imprisonment without parole.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that in states that have the death penalty, that the crime rate, the murder rate, is actually higher in states that don't.
That's pretty much what studies have demonstrated,
uh-huh.
That this culture of violence that the death penalty breeds tends to heighten the level of violence rather than lower it, as its proponents argue.
What brought me to oppose the death penalty was learning about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case and about becoming convinced that he is totally innocent and is wrongfully convicted. And then I started to learn about many other people. And as far as I know, there's been 89 people proven innocent and removed from death row since.
Right, and that number may even be up a little higher now. I think the last count I heard was about 95. And I think that's a very tricky area, because we have this attitude in this country that if a person's guilty, it's okay to run roughshod over their constitutional rights. And I think from that mentality flows this idea that, you know, when we know folks are clearly guilty, why are we fighting over these technicalities and worrying about all these procedural niceties and so on and so forth?
Well, we don't know that somebody's guilty until they've been, you know, given a fair trial, which doesn't always happen.
Well,
so.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of form over substance in the criminal justice system. So a lot of times the court systems will state that you've had a fair trial because you were able to put on some evidence in front of 12 people and so on and so forth. So
well,
I think there are a lot of illusions about
That's up for
the
dispute.
The way the system works, okay, number
mm-hmm.
one. But I think this notion that we have about not needing to protect the rights of those we know who are clearly guilty, and I mean, there are a lot of cases where we're very clear who the person is who did the crime, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But what Americans need to understand is those protections are there for the innocent, and the fact that the guilty benefit from them is just a side issue to the larger point that we need to protect the rights of the innocent. And so those technicalities, while they seem annoying, are there so that when a person who is innocent is caught in the snare, we do have some means of at least trying to ensure, to the degree that human beings can do that, and that's a big question, that, you know, the person who has been convicted is actually the person who's guilty. And that hasn't always been the case in the system.
No.
The fact that a few innocent people have now been brought into the limelight so that folks are aware of it should make folks know that that sort of thing has been going on for a long time. And I think the other point, too, is to make that there are a lot of people who are charged with capital crimes who should never have been charged with an offense that serious because of other circumstances related to the offense. So maybe they should have been charged with manslaughter or second-degree murder. But because of all the politics that attends this, because so many people make their careers based on how tough they are on crime, how many people they got sentenced to death, and so on and so forth, then the whole thing gets skewed and perverted way out of kilter with what a just result would be.
Killing people to get elected.
Exactly.
I don't think that innocence is the only reason by any means to oppose the death penalty, but I would like to talk about it a little bit. Now, you are an attorney for someone on death... Well, you're a death row attorney, so can you talk about maybe some specific cases that you know of in which there's reason to believe or somebody is innocent?
There are certainly some cases where mistaken identity is very viable. I mean, I know of one case in particular. There is evidence in the case that the assailant was white and this defendant is an African American. So I think there are cases like that with these glaring facts that say so clearly that this is not the person, that there's no physical evidence, that the eyewitnesses have identified somebody of a different race entirely and that sort of thing. I think that is not an uncommon occurrence in these cases. I think that it also happens not only with respect to cross-racial identification, but I think it happens within groups as well, so that because of some of the attitudes of law enforcement, people of color are seen as fungible, so one black defendant will do just as well as another. And, you know, there are attitudes on that side of the aisle, the law enforcement side, that say, well, if the person didn't do this one, they probably did something else, so they deserve it. And I think there are a lot of things that impel people to think that the death penalty is an appropriate outcome when, in point of fact, a lot of other things are pointing to another result that would be more appropriate. So it's a troubling situation, and I think that a lot of people are hiding behind innocence and DNA as though if we address those things, we'll have solved all the flaws in the death penalty system, and I think that is an insupportable position.
You're saying that so many people, there's a lot of people who oppose death penalty saying, well, if we can just repair the system by making sure that innocent people don't end up on death row, and we can do that with, in some cases, with DNA testing, that we'll have fixed it and that the death penalty will be okay, and
yeah,
you
and
don't agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that.
Why not?
Because, number one, I think there are a lot of cases where DNA is not an available option for determining who did the crime. I mean, there are instances where there's no physical evidence that they preserved or found at the scene to tie the charged defendant to the crime. And therefore, there's no DNA evidence that can be tested.
And that's the case in that one case you just mentioned, isn't that right? Where African-American man has been convicted of a murder when the eyewitnesses said that the killers were white.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, there are instances like that where, you know, because of the pressure that's put on police officers, they don't want to admit their mistakes. I mean, and so evidence disappears, you know, it's just astounding the kinds of things that go on. And people are okay with it because they think, well, he did this really horrible crime. And in point of fact, they may not have even been the person who did it.
They've convinced themselves that the individual's guilty and that no matter what
right.
crime they commit to convict, it's justified.
Right, and all that is fueled by the media attention. You know, it's the whole undercurrent of the politics of death that, you know, you're going to hear about it on the news. They're going to show you the crime scene. They're going to show you the body. They're going to show you all the details of the apprehension of this horrible, horrible person. And this is the crime that they're alleged to have committed. But they may say alleged, but by the time the people who are the potential jurors hear it, he's already tried, convicted, and sentenced. And I mean, it doesn't take much to convince people, you know, once they get a little publicity run going. I mean, people are quick to believe the worst. And then we haven't even discussed the cultural layer that attends this whole thing. Because of Americans' fascination, deification, and glorification of violence. And we as a public glorify and perpetuate this stuff as much as law enforcement does, as much as the media does. I mean, we're the ones who go to the movies, you know, the horror flicks, all those things, our penchant for violence and our bloodlust and our bloodthirstiness fuels all this kind of behavior. And then we wonder why our kids, you know, shoot up schools. And so I think we all have to look at what part we play in the whole death penalty dance, because either by our acquiescence in this stuff or our silence or our active participation in a lot of the behaviors and activities that sort of fuel this mentality, we all are part of perpetuating this problem.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on more than 18 non-commercial, micro-powered, community, and web-based radio stations, including KPAH, on the World Wide Web at www.perumpradio.com. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net, or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061, or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A Infos Radio Project and Independent Media Center for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Old Lady Scar Arms and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.